We seek refuge in Allah from the accursed Satan. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello, and welcome to our viewers all over the world to another edition of our program, Islamic Studies. This program is being broadcast to you by Sahar Universal Network from the Islamic Republic of Iran, from the holy city of Qum, and I'm your regular host on this program, Ijaz Hussain. The program is the continuation today on the theme of the effects of society and social development by juridical opinion. And what we discussed from our program from last session was the fact that, first of all, there's a process to be discussed about in terms of how law is derived. And we were talking about it particularly in the absence of the imam, that, you know, exactly what is that process. And then we were talking about the boundaries of how legal opinion is derived and the use of logic and the intellect as well. Of course, there is a body of opinion that says that, for example, we were given an example that if the imam, for example, says about alcohol that it is considered unclean, then the scholars have a certain room for maneuver in terms of how they determine the level of the fact that this thing, how impermissible it actually is. And there's a lot of flexibility in terms of the opinions that scholars can come up with or jurists can come up with. So that was one of the examples we were being given. And now we were going to go on to the process of how the society itself can influence the juridical opinion. Of course, we are also talking about the institutions of Walayat al-Faqih. We are talking about the supreme jurist being the body of opinion or the expert who can guide society, because that's what we're really talking about. We are talking about prosperity and the guidance of society towards an ultimate goal, and the ultimate goal is our purification and perfection in this world. So we're going to carry on with this discussion after a short break. So please stay with us. We'll be right back. Thank you. Welcome back, viewers. Thanks very much for staying with us. There's an email that will be subtitled on the screen. Please use it if you feel you want to make any contributions to the program. We'd love to hear from you. I'd like to introduce my expert in the studio on the subject of juridical opinion or the impact on social development by juridical opinion. And I have the honor and pleasure once again of having Sheikh Hamza Sodagar from the Holy Seminaries of Qum. A warm welcome to you, sir, and salam.
Wa alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullah to yourself and all the viewers. Thank you for having me again.
Thank you very much. Well, sir, I hope I covered some of the points that we mentioned from the session last week. I think you mentioned a very important ingredient in terms of this whole process of not only arriving at a particular juridical opinion or a legal ruling for a particular situation or particular circumstances, but you mentioned the fact that taqwa and piety are also a vital ingredient in terms of seeing this successfully implemented in society. But I leave it to your good self to explain this further, that why these things are necessary, because of course in secular societies they have the law, they derive the law, which we compared, I think, in the last session that we came up with the fact that Parliament comes up with the law, they try to apply it to the through the legal processes, through the courts, whatever. But of course, you know, they don't look at this aspect, that where does this come in? So it's very interesting that why in Islam that is vital in terms of seeing a successful application of the divine law. Yeah.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I think that was very important. We try to stress on it. After stressing on the idea that Islam within the realm of fiqh or jurisprudence, and there being a legal opinion which it has approved of, has definitely left flexibility and left room for jurists to derive and arrive at different opinions.
Sure.
And that's only natural when you're talking about human intellect.
Yes.
And the idea of a human being understanding two people looking at the same evidence are not probably going to come up with the exact same understanding, although they may be very similar. Mm-hmm. At least there's a lot of room for a difference of opinion. And therefore, there is flexibility that is definite. However, that flexibility, we stressed, is given certain boundaries. You cannot cross certain boundaries.
Yes.
These are discussed, the specifics of what those boundaries are discussed in the discipline of usul al-fiqh. Mm-hmm. But what you're talking about is the third element that we mentioned, and that is, it's not sufficient to be flexible within the boundaries to arrive at an opinion. Mm-hmm. The objective isn't arriving at an opinion that falls within the boundaries.
Sure.
And you can have somewhat of a legal justification within the parameters.
Sure.
That's not the objective. The objective is arriving at divine law. There is divine law. Mm-hmm. It's not unwritten. There is written law by the divine. We are trying to arrive at that. Mm-hmm. We're not trying to simply come up with a legal opinion as long as it's within the boundaries. Although, as I said, in the end, we're not going to be sure which one is the actual legal or divine law.
Sure.
But our objective is to arrive at that. And that's why piety is very important. Because piety is what controls the motives of a human being. If one's motivation is to be obedient to the divine, to understand what the divine wants of him, not to justify what he's doing in order to be saved in the court of the divine. The person really wants to do what the divine wants him to do. That's the objective. Only if that is the objective, we're going to move on the right tracks and be moving in the right direction. If the motivation changes, then you may be able to use those parameters and explain things based on those parameters, but the conclusion will be an incorrect conclusion, and we will know that from the beginning, and that's a very dangerous direction to move towards. And that's why that was very important.
So it begs the question in terms of, you know, the effect of social development on society, that in what way does that influence the process? Because as you quite rightly say, the law is there, you know, we have it in scripture. It's a matter of us, as you quite rightly say, arriving at the clear understanding of what that divine law actually means to clarify. Because of course you mentioned this point, that we are in a situation where we don't have our imam, and of course if the imam was here, he would have, you know, simply given us the guidance to arrive at the necessary conclusion. But because we don't have that, we have a situation where, you know, scholars are trying to come up with the accurate assessment of the divine law. But how does society then influence that decision that they come up with?
First, I think it's important for us to make a note of that social development does influence legal opinion.
Right.
Okay. Now, we don't have time here to go over the history and give specific examples, but for those who've gone through that, they will clearly see that in different times, under different circumstances, political circumstances, social circumstances, a jurist being amongst a predominantly Sunni audience or being in an area where they're surrounded by Shia has an effect on the development.
Sure.
And we, I think, stated this from Shahid Mutahhari to kind of give a little bit of context to this, where he mentions that the opinion, the legal opinion of a jurist that is born and raised in the village has the scent and the aroma of the village.
Village, of course.
And the jurist that lives in a city, his legal opinion has the aroma of the city. You can sense This comes from a person that has been raised or has lived in a city.
Okay. It's a very
the first point that we need to understand. Sure. Mm. There is an effect that society has on the opinions of the jurists.
Sure.
Okay.
So you're saying to a large extent, is this a cultural influence, or are you also...
Culture may be an influence. It's
influence,
not the only influence.
Yeah.
But, I mean, culture is one where we could discuss...
Sure.
Climate even may be something. Shahid Mutahhari gives that as an example as well.
Interesting.
There's many things that will have an impact. As we said, we mentioned in one of the previous sessions when we talked about the flexibility.
That's right.
Okay,
yes.
This is where the flexibility comes
in.
Mm-hmm. Because the person is raised in a certain environment, that understanding that they have regarding whatever it may be is going to have an impact on their understanding of the scripture. Even teachers. Who are the teachers of this individual? Have an impact.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Where even Arabic grammar, where the person learned Arabic grammar, has an impact. Sometimes is the person Arab or they are non-Arab that they have learned the Arabic language.
Yes.
These have different impacts. There is a difference in that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, since we're talking about the effect of social developments and society, on legal opinion, let's try to focus on that. I'll try to talk about that. And I hope that this discussion will have the effect of clarifying for people something with regards to their religion that will strengthen the understanding that they have of religion instead of weaken it. Some people may be some of the very religious, God-fearing individuals that have had an understanding of religion and their following of the fatwa of the maraja, which has been handed to them from the generations before, may now feel, what are we talking about? Are we saying that this is haphazard, or you know, anyone can come up with any opinion, or these different effects have happened within time, so are we actually applying divine law? I hope this confusion doesn't arise.
Yes, because
based on what I mentioned before, and I will stress this again very briefly, that this was introduced by the imams, and this flexibility within the boundaries, within the red lines, with piety is something they have introduced. Okay, so they knew this, they implemented this, they encouraged this at their time, with their own presence at their time, for us to be able to come up with this understanding.
Sure.
Now, I want to say that the influence of society on legal opinion is going to be in one of three areas.
Right.
Okay. Now, I don't claim that these are the only areas where there could be an influence, but these are three areas that we do see there is influence.
Okay.
One area that we see social developments having an influence on legal opinion is the idea of a certain social phenomena causing the jurists, the scholars, the ulama, the mujtahideen, to look over an area of jurisprudence or Islamic law that they had previously looked at, but not as thoroughly. They will revisit that.
Revisit it, yes.
And review all the evidence that's there, all of the verses and all of the ahadith, to see if that previous understanding was correct or not.
Mm-hmm.
Let me expand on the concept itself and then see if we can find any examples.
Sure.
If there is a discussion within the verses and the ahadith with regards to a particular topic, it has been introduced in those verses and the ahadith. It's there.
Okay.
The explanations are there.
Sure.
Because the explanations are there, the scholars going through those ahadith, they will derive some opinion with regards to that. However, the amount of effort they would put in that discussion is going to be less, okay?
Sure.
Because it's something, or let me explain this, it will be less if that particular topic, which has been addressed in the verses and the ahadith, is not something that they're dealing with at that time.
Yes.
Okay?
Sure.
I'll give one example and then move on to another example.
Yes.
In most of Shia history, the idea of Islamic government was something which was practically not possible.
That's okay? Correct, yes.
It was practically just not possible. They were a minority, small pockets of Shia population within the Muslim world, scattered in the different regions of the Muslim world, but never in a particular region a dominant majority in a way where they could have political power. Mm-hmm. Okay. So although the concept of Islamic government is very clearly addressed in the verses of the Ahadith, in the verses of the Holy Quran, and in the Ahadith of the Holy Prophet and the Ahlul
Bayt. But it was not, it couldn't be practical.
It couldn't be
implemented or practical at that particular moment.
And that's why the discussions regarding this were not discussions that were treated as thoroughly as some of the other discussions.
Sure.
Okay. Now, on this particular example, let me mention this. Because of the, on this particular subject of Islamic government, when you look at the history of the jurists and their discussions regarding this particular topic, you will see that in the context of post Al-Ghaybatul Al-Sughra, in other words, after Al-Ghaybatul Sughra, or the minor occultation and the major occultation, where the Imam was completely unreachable, when that era began, there were still some influence of the political movement of the Ahlul Bayt and the encouragement for there to be such a movement, a politically active movement amongst the Shia, which was something that the Ahlul Bayt very clearly did. Now that's a different discussion, which we would have to spend many sessions on to clarify some misconceptions regarding that. A lot of people think that the Ahlul Bayt were not involved politically during much of their lives and many of the Imams, which is completely incorrect. It's not true.
No.
It's a misunderstanding, let me put it that way.
Sure.
But taking it as a given that they did very actively get involved with the social political context that they lived in, their encouragement to be involved with that, we see carries on for a century or two after the occultation begins. Okay. What do we mean by that? We mean that, for example, if you look at the works of Abu Salah al-Halabi, who passed away in the 5th century after the Hijrah, a contemporary of Shaykh al-Tusi, or if you look at Qadi ibn al-Barraj and his works, you will be amazed at the language that they have with regards to Islamic government. You would think, if I would just read the words of Abu Salah al-Halabi or Ibn al-Barraj, you would probably think that these are the words of Imam Khomeini translated into Arabic. And you think they're very contemporary.
Mm.
But the fact of the matter is that these are actually centuries old. Almost 1,000 years, if not already 1,000 years old in the lunar calendar. Mm. Almost 1,000 years old. Okay, so this discussion was very lively at that time.
Sure.
And it's not just one scholar, it's a number of scholars. Now, they didn't have Islamic government.
No.
And that was also not something that was in view for them in the near history. They were just considering that of the coming to an end of the occultation, the Imam arriving. But nevertheless, the discussion of Islamic government was very lively. As I said, this is because of the effects of the work of the Ahlul Bayt, encouraging this idea, which got its way into jurisprudence. But then later on, we see after this generation, we see gradually, because there's no talk of that, that motivation is not there, the discussions start to sort of die out. And for a few centuries, you don't see much discussion there about this.
Well, that's a good point just to have a break at the moment, because for a few centuries, we don't see anything about that. But viewers, please stay with us, and we'll be back with this discussion right after this break. Thank you. Welcome back, viewers. Thanks very much for staying with us. You're watching Islamic Studies. I'm your host, Ijaz Hussain, and we are speaking with Sheikh Hamza Sodagar on this very interesting example about political Islamic government, and the fact that there was a discussion, a theory that was set out for the implementation of an Islamic government. But as you quite rightly mentioned, we don't see anything about it because, as you say, for a variety of reasons, as history tells us, that this was something that was not foreseen. It would have been foreseen, but the fact is that the circumstances were not there to put it into practice. But as you say, that from these scholars like Abu Saleh Halabi, that the words are echoing of that of Imam Khomeini, God bless his great soul. So this is why I would understand now from what you're saying that why Imam Khomeini would say that this was Islamic in terms of the system that he put in place, but because he got the opportunity to bring it into being.
I'll try to get to understand fully what this one example of how society plays a role in a discussion that is discussed, or the very fact of jurists and scholars discussing a topic. This is one influence, and we're mentioning this as an example.
Yes.
We said that it was because of the social environment that was created by the ma'sumin, by the imams, during their presence, and the discussions of the change of government in the Sunni world. This is also something that I didn't introduce. Mm. This was also there, that those discussions were very lively at that point as well. This is towards the end of the Abbasid dynasty's rule.
That's right,
Getting close to the end, not too close, but it's getting close to that. And there are a lot of rivals as well within the Islamic world, and they all have the claims that they are the Khulafa of the Holy Prophet. These are Islamic governments.
Sure.
So because of those discussions being lively, you see that discussion occurring in the 4th and 5th century. Sheikh Al-Mufid, Abu Salah Al-Halabi, as I mentioned, Qadi Ibn al-Barraj, Sheikh Al-Tusi, and others discuss this matter. And in addition, let me just again to see how society plays a role in a particular dimension of a subject being discussed. For example, those very scholars that talked about this Islamic government, they more specifically discussed it from the perspective of if a tyrant, in other words, an unjust ruler, an un-Islamic ruler, a ruler that does not have the right to rule based on Islamic law, if such a person who is in control, and we can't really overthrow that person, if that person suggests to a Shia, a follower of the Ahlul Bayt, to take on the responsibility of governing in a certain region, to be the governor of Iraq, to be the governor of Khorasan, or to be the governor of Isfahan, or some other region, is that legitimate or not? This is what they discussed, and in that discussion they said, yes, it is legitimate, but not for all Shias. It is only legitimate for a Shia jurist, a mujtahid. Why? Because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given through the Ahlul Bayt. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given that authority to the Holy Prophet to the Ahlul Bayt to the jurists. Since the jurists have this authority, if it is given to them by a ruler who is not even just, but this would be an opportunity, in their words, I'm explaining what the jurists are saying. This would be an opportunity that, although apparently it seems that an unjust ruler is providing for this jurist, in reality, this is an opportunity that God has provided. They have got to take that responsibility on and govern that region based on the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt. And their rule of that region is going to be legitimate, not because this unjust ruler has given them that authority, but because the imams have given that authority.
Permission.
They haven't discussed this subject from the perspective of, should we have an uprising to set up the Islamic government? They haven't discussed that too much, if anything at all. I'm leaving that space. The works that I have studied, I haven't come across that discussion. So if somebody's discussed it, it's not the dominant view or the dominant discussion. The discussion is dominated by this question, if this is presented, the position of being the governor of a certain region. If this position is presented to a Shia, are they allowed to take it or not? So you see, the social context, which is that a certain government is ruling, and the only opportunity we may have is that that ruler, which we don't accept as the divine ruler, sure, if they give us an opportunity to rule, is that legitimate to accept or is it not legitimate to accept? That's the discussion. That's the context.
That's from the legal perspective.
The legal perspective that is discussed is this very particular angle of it. But uprisings, is it wajib for us to create an environment or an opportunity to be able to rule or not? They haven't seriously discussed that because it's not something that they're foreseeing in the near future.
Yes.
For many centuries after that, as I said, because of the circumstances that the Ahlul Bayt are not, you know, that motivation that was created by the Ahlul Bayt has kind of gradually moved away because people don't see that coming. Sure. They don't have that, the imams constantly encouraging them that, no, this will be possible, you need to work towards it. Because we don't have that, and the social context is that there are unjust rulers, we don't see much of that going on. When does this start up again? Mainly during the time of the Safavid dynasty.
Ah.
When the Shias, which this the Safavid dynasty is not an Islamic government, let me make that clear.
That's true.
Okay, yes. Because it was not led by jurists.
No.
The Islamic system of government has got to be led by jurists.
It was still a monarchy.
It was definitely a monarchy.
But had this is what I was going to point out, that for our viewers as well, to, you know, to kind of simplify our discussion a little bit, is that the fact that, you know, we still had the rulers, the rulership of kings, but the problem was that some of them had some Shia leanings, or they had some sympathy with the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt. And in this case, this is where you quite rightly point out that this is where the discussion would be focused, that if there is an opportunity for a legal expert, a mujtahid, to have an opportunity to govern and to implement divine law, even though the system itself has, you know, has no real relevance with that. But as you quite rightly say, this is an opportunity to at least get the groundwork there, to get people the understanding of what is the application and the understanding of divine law for a variety
but
of
see,
reasons.
Shia government, and look, it's a long story of what the Safavid dynasty was.
Yes,
okay?
Sure.
This was in the ninth, 10th, 11th century, probably carrying on a little further of after Hijrah. This is the Hijri calendar.
Of course, it's about 500-600 years in the Christian calendar ago, roughly, about 15th century.
So during the time of the Safavids, in order to establish their government and their roots, in Iran, they brought in the Shia jurists, and they made it seem like they have a lot of authority. At times, they did give them quite some authority and freedom and liberty to do certain things, but it wasn't genuine, meaning that the king still had control, and they definitely didn't allow that control to be taken away by jurists. They were very strictly under control, but they made it seem, for their own good, that the jurists are in control somewhat.
Sure.
Okay. To be able to win over the people. Mm-hmm. Now the scholars came in because Shia government become something that is a little more relevant. Mm. The discussions again start to be there. You find them in the works of Al-Muhaqqiq Al-Karaki, who is Amili. He is from Jabal Amil in Lebanon of today. And he is brought into Iran along with others, like the father of Bahauddin al-Amili and Bahauddin himself. He's a child when he comes. Both of them are Amili. They're both Lebanese, and many others as well.
Well, you'll have to tell us the... you leave us in suspense, actually, as far as this story is concerned, because we've just run out of time on this session of the program regarding this very interesting discussion on this particular topic about Islamic government and the developments, the social impact on its development. But we'll leave that for another session. But I just want to thank you for your contribution today on the subject. And I'd like to thank my viewers for watching the program today. And I hope you've benefited somewhat from this discussion. But we hope to carry on with this very important topic next week. So please tune in for that. But it just leaves me to say, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you for watching. Goodbye.